This is another episode of Connecting the Dots podcast. I'm Brad Parsons, Vice President of Market Operations at Baptist Memorial Healthcare.
And I'm Jake Lancaster, an internal medicine physician and the Chief Medical Officer for the Baptist Medical Group.
Today, we are very excited to have Andrew Brodsky join us. Andrew is the author of a new book called Ping, The Secrets of Successful Virtual Communication. Andrew's got a lot to share on this topic. We think it's really appropriate. So, Andrew, welcome to Connecting the Dots.
Thanks for having me on the show today.
So, tell us a little bit about, again, today we're even connecting on a virtual platform that's, we just said, this has made this podcast possible. It makes so much of what we do today possible. So, tell us a little bit about Ping and the story behind your new book.
Yeah, happy to. Actually fits well that I'm talking to Baptist Medical Group today. So my initial interest in virtual communication started when I was a teenager. So the background is I'd only been feeling sick for a couple of weeks. My parents were concerned. They brought me to the hospital for some blood tests. And they figured they'd give me some antibiotics, I'd be gone. But my white blood cell count was over 100,000. And so here's this doctor who's suddenly telling us that you have cancer. And for me, as a 16-year-old who's thinking about applying to college, this is like a pretty shocking statement. And maybe as part of a coping mechanism, I started to wonder about, like, what is it like for the doctor to have to tell someone who's 16 years old that they have cancer? And then thereafter, I spent a couple years doing chemotherapy, radiation, did a bone marrow transplant. So I was in one of those isolation rooms. So early on, in addition to my interest in communication, I was interacting with a lot of people from a distance. I'm very healthy today, but I was left with an immune deficiency that in current times of things being passed around a lot means that this is still something that's relevant to me because very often I'm still having to interact with others at a distance. And then when I began my PhD at Harvard Business School and I had to choose a research topic, I went with something that I cared about, virtual communication. How can we do this better? What are we getting wrong? What are we getting right? How can we improve this for everyone? And that led to my stream of research now as a professor at UT Austin and with my recent book, Ping, The Secrets of Successful Virtual Communication.
Well, it's phenomenal to have you. And again, I'll just echo Brad's sentiments that I love this conversation. I think it is long overdue for us. You know, since the pandemic hit, us as an organization, we have been doing almost all of our meetings virtually for the past 5 years. And I'm 100% convinced that we do not do them well. And we just made the abrupt jump from mostly in-person meetings, occasional virtual meetings to 100% virtual most of the time with now the occasional in-person meeting. And then, and so yes, I want to dive deep into what are the common things you see that are going wrong with virtual meetings in particular. But then I also understand from your book that you talk a lot about digital communication in general, email, you know, we have email, we got Slack, we got Teams, we got text, we got everything. And none of us were trained in how to do that. And most of, you know, I do it great, but yeah, a lot of people on our team struggle with it. So, you know, where do we even start with this subject? Where would you think we should begin when we think about this new medium that we all are living in and are not using well?
Yeah, it's a good point you're making. And when I talk to a lot of organizations who have the option to be remote, so obviously if you're a hospital, for many people, they don't have that option to be remote. But one thing many executives and leaders are missing is that in contemporary organizations, regardless of whether you work from the home, the office, hybrid, we're now all virtual communicators. The old way in the office was if you had a question, you'd go and ask someone, but you'd be interrupting whatever they did to do it. Whether it was you knock on their office or go to their cubicle. Now, instead, we send instant messages, Slack messages, text messages. Even if someone's, you know, on the same floor as us, and this is true of doctors and nurses as well. And the benefit here is, A, you're not having to travel, even if it's a few feet to the other person, and B, you're not necessarily interrupting whatever they're doing. They can respond at an appropriate time. If they're seeing a patient, they can wait. If they're focused on paperwork, they can wait till they're done. You're not constantly getting interrupted. So the way I want to think about this is to transform our thinking from remote versus not to we're all virtual communicators, regardless of where we work. So we need to figure out how to do this better, regardless. To your question about what is the biggest mistakes? There's a lot. If I had to pick one particularly big one, it's that people tend to be pretty mindless when it comes to their choice of mode of communication. And for any listeners who have had hours and hours of wasted meetings, you know this to be true. But on the other side, extremes aren't the right choice, because if you have an email chain that's gone on for weeks and weeks that could have been handled by a 5-minute phone call, but no one ever does it, you understand the other extreme isn't good either. So pausing and taking a more strategic approach to your interaction, saying, is this the right mode? Will this achieve what I'm aiming to hear? Can actually make people a lot more productive. It can improve relationships, and it can help improve your overall well-being, because you can reduce this communication burnout or overload that happens due to ineffective communication.
Yeah, Andrew, I really like that. And again, it's getting people to pause and getting people to think. What do you think? What have you learned that looks like? I mean, is that a training course? Is it how do you bring that awareness? Because again, I think a lot of this is communication that we're just doing. I mean, it's become the work. You know, plowing through 100 emails is just part of the day today. How do you create that space and time to pause and think?
So when I do this, there's a variety of ways. So I run a separate organization, Ping Group, where I do a lot of training, consulting with organizations on how to improve these things. And the first step is just learning and realizing that you're making these mistakes, and then trying to figure out, well, what's the best thing to do? And there's a whole bunch of research out there. But as an example of one tool that I like to use is I created this communication norming tool. It's available for free in my company's website, pinggroup.org. But what this tool focuses on is there's an effect in research called the email urgency bias, which is what started part of this one particular tool. And the idea behind this is that if someone gets an email from somebody else, especially after hours, it turns out the recipient on average expects that the sender wants a response much more quickly than they do. So, you know, if I get an email from either of you, you know, Brad or Jake, and I'd be like, oh, you know, here's some important medical executives, podcast hosts, et cetera. Like, they probably want a response really quickly. But in reality, on the other side, you two are like, I am so busy. I've got 200 emails. I'd actually prefer maybe if Andrew didn't get back to me right away. And the issue with this is that the expectation as a recipient that you need to respond right away, it creates stress, because you're constantly having to check your messages, even outside of work hours. And you're having to interrupt other things you're doing, whether it's your focus on work tasks or just time with your family. So this tool, that one of the tools I created, basically is used for teams to think about, okay, what do we use to communicate for what? What's best? But taking that a step further and saying, well, what are our response expectations for this? And let's agree as a team. So maybe we agree, emails, we should respond within 24 hours. Instant messages or Slack messages, we should respond maybe within 2 hours if it's during the workday. That way, if you have a meeting or you're involved in something, you don't have to interrupt it. And if there's something urgent, we will do a text message, or we'll have some tag that's it's urgent. And that way, it has a few benefits. One of them is that you no longer need to check your phone after hours. If there's something urgent, then you will hear that text chime. And the other thing people do is they start getting used to saying, hey, it'd be great if you give me a response in like by tomorrow or by next week, as opposed to just leaving it ambiguous, which creates more pressure on the recipient. But even on the sender side, this is useful. And I'm guessing most listeners have been in this situation where you send an email, the other person didn't respond. And you're like, is it okay to follow up? Is it weird? And by having these conversations as a team in advance about, okay, we respond within 24 hours to email or whatever you decide, it's no longer weird to follow back up, because you've already created those norms. And this avoids the ambiguity where, you know, young people might think differently than older people, or people who prefer different technology have different perceptions. When you get everyone on the same page, it can reduce stress and improve the productivity of those teams.
No, yeah, that's really interesting. And thinking about mode of communication based on the generation, I think is interesting. there's some, Brad, you probably know within the organization that are, they're going to call you no matter what. And they're never, I've never gotten an email from them. It's been a phone call and maybe a text message, but most of the time it's a phone call, and that we're just going to stop there. But thinking about what is appropriate for what time frame that you need something to be followed up on, I think is nice, because some people just think phone calls are better than emails. Mm-hmm. That is a better, more effective way to communicate regardless of the type of message and the urgency for the message. Is that the case with certain mediums? Like, should certain messages mm-hmm. only happen in certain mediums? Should they only happen in email? Should they only happen in person or over the phone? You know, what are your thoughts on that?
I wish I could say there's just one best mode of communication, although it'd make for a short book. The idea here is that each mode has its strengths and it depends. Phone can be useful if, for instance, you're a doctor on call and you need to respond right away so you can talk to the person as they're having a potential emergency. You know, that allows for that real time back and forth. If you're on a, if you're texting someone as they're trying to manage their kid who's having a major allergic reaction or something, it's going to be problematic. Whereas they can put you on speaker, there's some benefits there. But on the other side of that, let's think about other interactions about not being on call as a doctor. Let's say there's something, you know, you're filling in some paperwork or you're doing some task that requires input for someone else and you're blocked. What's the best choice then? So one, ideally you've established the communication norms previously. But beyond that, phone can be problematic in some cases because you're interrupting the other person. So if it's not truly an emergency, you create the situation where you're interrupting them. And if they don't pick up, then they're calling you back at some point that interrupts you. And that's why a lot of people hate phone, is it's kind of an imposition on others. And the other issue is that phone is not particularly useful for having a good record to review again. So if I have a great phone conversation with someone, that's great, maybe builds a good relationship. But if I'm trying to get information from that conversation and remember something from it, having a text-based record might have been really nice in a whole bunch of situations. So this gets this idea that the best mode is really going to depend on your goal for the interaction. And as one big example, cameras on or cameras off. This is a big topic I get from students, executives, everyone. Like, should we have cameras on or off during meetings? And here's what the research says. And it depends, not surprisingly. So cameras on is useful for building trust in early relationships because we trust what we know. If we don't know what someone looks like, if we don't know their mannerisms, they don't feel as human. It's hard to kind of form that feeling of trust. Additionally, cameras on is useful for providing what I would call the illusion of engagement. So to the other person, it makes you seem more engaged because it looks like you're looking at them. And as we're recording this, we have a video call, but the two of you don't know for a fact that I'm looking at you. I could have a dinner recipe up on my screen, or I could have like a YouTube video with closed captions playing in the background. But to you, it looks like I'm engaged. So there's value in seeming like you're engaged and for actually building trust early on. On the other side, there's research on Zoom fatigue or video conferencing fatigue that shows that being on camera is exhausting. You know, you're checking your teeth for broccoli. You're concerned about all your nonverbal behavior. And you could see the camera staring at you. So you feel like you're on stage, and that's exhausting. It reduces focus. And it's been shown in a whole number of studies that this happens. So taking this together, if it's an early stage relationship or your goal is to show you're engaged, cameras on are good. If you're a latter stage team and you've already built impressions of each other, and you know one other meeting is not going to change how you all feel about each other, maybe allow those cameras off. That way people can be more focused both during the meeting and more so afterwards as well, because they're not fatigued from this more exhausting meeting experience.
Yeah, Andrew, I want to build off that, because you bring up a concept that's called richness in mm-hmm. your book. And really, you know, there's a lot of dialogue in our organization about meaningful connection. Certainly in our business of healthcare, I mean, with our patients and our team members, meaningful connections are so important. So important for leaders to be able to do that. And a lot of times, I think our belief is that has to be in person. Mm-hmm. But I think some of your research and some of your experience has even said ways that you can create real and meaningful connections and have rich connections through virtual communication. So I'm wondering if you'll speak to that a little bit.
Yeah, and just as a simple example, think about if you've got two friends. For one of them, you see them 3 hours in time a person, but once every maybe 4 months or 3 or 4 months. So you see them maybe three or four times a year for 3 hours in person. The other person, you send a short text back and forth each day. So one person, you're just briefly texting every single day of the year. The other person you see for 3 hours in person only 3 to 4 times a year. Which friend do you think you're going to be closer to? The one you're texting every day or the one who you're seeing in person for 3 to 4 hours? And most people are going to say, well, it's the one I'm communicating with every single day, not the person I see 3 times a year. And if you think about it, the amount of time you spend just sending 1 to 2 texts a day is probably adds up to less than 3 hours once every 3 months, because it takes a few seconds to shoot off and read a text. So you're still spending the same amount of time, but the frequency of interaction here is more important in facilitating the relationship as opposed to the richness. You know, all else is equal. If you're going to meet in person or do a single text, yes, being in person is going to have a stronger effect, but that's not always the case. There's this either or, and there are these trade-offs. And thinking about, well, what are the strengths of these different modes and how can I best leverage them? So text is low effort. We don't have to make plans. We don't have to both be available. We don't have to find a babysitter or whatever else. And that frequency can be incredibly beneficial as a result. So it's really figuring out those levers and using them strategically as opposed to saying, only in person works. Only in person is best. And that's one of the best ways to kind of approach these things.
Let me ask another question about video meetings. Mm-hmm. So when we, again, when we started with the pandemic, we switched 100% in-person meetings to video meetings here at our corporate office. And even if we were down the hall from each other, me and Brad, if we were going to meet, we would meet via video. Fast forward 5 years later, we still do the same thing. It can be me and Brad down the hall from each other, next door to each other, and we will have meetings in video. Mm-hmm. Is there something inherently wrong with that? Should we be trying to force everybody, not force, but encourage everybody to meet in person again?
I think it really depends on the situation and the context. And there's trade-offs, right? The video, it's nice. You don't have to arrange a room to meet. One of you doesn't have to walk to the other one.
I can pull up something on my computer really easily. Yeah.
And it's awkward to meet in person where your both heads are in your laptop. Whereas like when you're on video, if your head's in your laptop, it still looks like you're looking at the other person, even though you've got files in front of you. So there's strengths and weaknesses. The big issue that I see people running into is we're just not as good at interacting virtually, which is part of my goal in doing this research. If you think about humanity, you know, by most estimates, we've been interacting in person for well over 100,000 years. If you look at how long we've been interacting over video, it's like this tiny bit of time here. We just haven't evolved to be good at it. We're not used to it. And so it doesn't come as naturally to us. That's not to say that it can't be better. It's just that we tend not to, you know, it's not something we're just born to be good at. One of the studies I did, though, where I looked at over 100 meetings, I saw some interesting trends happening as people were returning to the office following COVID. So the number of video meetings actually increased as people were going back to the office, but they started having fewer participants, and there were more of them that were spontaneous. So we're doing this call on Microsoft Teams, which is what I assume your organization uses. So the spontaneous meetings were basically using Meet Now as opposed to a calendar meeting. So there were more one-on-one spontaneous meetings happening. And basically what was happening is people were using video meetings as a water cooler. We're just going to have a casual video catch-up as opposed to this big group, you know, 20-person meeting. And research separately that's been done by others backs us up. The shorter meetings are with fewer participants, the more engaging they are. So people are getting better and better at using these tools as opposed to having these like long 2 hour, 20 person meetings, which really just end up being exhausting for everyone. And in many cases should have just been an email in the first place.
We've got a lot of listeners from our organization here at Baptist Memorial Healthcare, but we've got listeners in healthcare kind of really all over the world that listen on a weekly basis. And so I like to come back to a very practical application of all the modes of virtual communication we have today. If someone wants to say, you know, or to to be better at communication, certainly in the virtual space? How do they get started and what should they be thinking about?
Yeah, so if you're feeling like you need to be better at it, that's a good first step. As I was kind of talking about, the worst thing we do is we just do this all mindlessly. It's always a meeting, so we're going to do it as a meeting. This is an email, we're going to do it as email. So you're already way ahead of the game if you're thinking about how can I do this better. For me, it's the same topic I recommend for any students. Learn. You know, find good resources out there to read about this stuff. Try and learn some of the research. There's a lot of, you know, interesting stuff out there. And I mean, this is a topic that's pretty relevant for medicine. Telemedicine's been such a hot topic right now. Is it good? Is it bad? In the beginning of my book, I actually do a little play on this where I kind of talk about my cancer diagnosis, which was in person. And you know, I talk about the strengths of it, where the doctor actually hugged one of my parents and they could see all our nonverbal behavior and react to that. But then I flip it on its head and said, well, imagine if it's virtual. And everyone's instinct is, well, that's worse to get a cancer diagnosis virtually. But then if you think about the fact that the family is sitting in the comfort of their home, they don't have to check out and go through a sterile waiting room with tons of people. They don't have to drive home as the kid's nauseous from being sick. Like, there are all these different costs and benefits to the different modes. And being more thoughtful about that and ideally understanding the research behind, well, what's better in what case, can be great for ensuring that your interactions are more effective, that you make the impressions that you want, that you make it better for the other person.
Yeah, I really like that. I want to flip it around too and say, I think we've all, you know, gotten that email that kind of makes our blood pressure go up, right? Maybe it's expected, but maybe usually it's unexpected for me. But it's and sometimes I've misread it and certainly misinterpreted maybe the intent. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you talked about and had a great answer for things we can do. What about as we receive some of that communication, how should we position ourselves to do that better?
That's a good one. And this is a common problem, this email misinterpretation. In my book, I have a framework, the PING framework. I'm just going to talk about the first part of it, so I'm not going on too long. But the P, which is what I start with, is perspective taking for this reason. One of the teaching activities I do with MBA students is based on research on this topic as it relates to virtual communication. So the original study was a Stanford study where they'd have two people. One person would tap out a song on the desk, and they would ask that person, how confident are you that the other person will guess it correctly? And you could do this exercise with a friend, with your kid, with your partner. And then the second person would guess. Well, the first person who was a tapper was very confident, like 80, 90%, this is easy. But the second person almost never got it right. And the reason is that when you're tapping the music on your desk, you hear the music in your head. It seems obvious to you. But when the person on the receiving side is hearing it, all they hear is tap, 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 tap. And then they don't hear it as well. And what another set of researchers did is they tied this to email and misinterpretation of emotion. When we are writing emails, they showed, we are very confident about our ability to relay emotion. And they showed participants were like, oh yeah, 90% they'll get that I was sarcastic or angry or whatever. And the percentage was very low of people actually guess the correct emotion. And it's because we hear the emotion in our heads as we're typing out an email or text, whatever. Whereas on the other side, they're coming from a different set of assumptions, information. And, you know, for instance, if you're a manager, a leader, and you know, a subordinate, someone working for you, sends you something and you reply, thanks, period. To you, it's like, okay, great. I'm thanking them. It was good work. But on their side, they're like, I just sent them 20 pages and they sent me thanks with a period. They must hate this. And the problem is like, no one's really wrong here, but we didn't realize we were misinterpreting. So as an example of perspective taking on the sender side, coming from this research study, they showed one of the best things you could do if you're concerned about misinterpretation or if it's a high stakes communication, take that message you wrote and read it aloud in the opposite tone you intended. So if it's serious, read it as sarcastic. It's sarcastic, serious, angry, happy, etc. And what happened was when participants read these messages out loud in the opposite tone, they were suddenly like, oh, wait, that is not as clear as I intended it to be. And they then kind of corrected that. And you could think about, maybe I should call or do something else here. On the receiving side, you want to think about, did they mean what they did? And if it feels like there might be a situation where there's conflict, maybe we should move this off of email. Say, hey, can we hop, just I have a few clarifying questions. Can we hop on a quick call? And that way you can actually gauge what's going on and have that back and forth. One of the worst things that happens with text-based communication is sometimes there's conflict and only one person knows about it. So if I send an email and someone is offended by it, or they're angry, or they're upset, I don't see that. I don't see their facial expression. So I may never know as a sender. So as a recipient, actually trying to have that conversation and be clear about it. And if there is actually a problem, resolve it. But if there's not, discovering that there's not, as opposed to just stewing on it and being angry, is the right approach to take in those situations.
Yeah, I feel like there's a lot that we can do to improve email communication. And email's been around for a long time now. When you were talking about the tone of the email and not putting the exclamation mark, it made me think of that Seinfeld episode, I don't know if you remember, where they were very upset that they didn't put the exclamation mark about congrats on the new baby.
Mm-hmm. Hey, always could use a good Seinfeld reference.
Yeah. I mean, this is a good point, too, about how long some of this stuff's been around, because different generations have different perceptions of it. So I'm an elder millennial. I grew up where, for the most part, the only easy text-based communication when I was younger was email. We could text on our cell phones, but you had to like hit the 2 button 3 times to get to C and like right. Hit the, you know, whatever, each button multiple times gets the right letter. So we used email for pretty much all text-based communication.
Oh, we had AOL. Don't forget about that.
Oh, yeah. Instant messaging did come up back then, too. So that was just kind of early on, the instant messaging thing.
Yeah.
But, you know, for younger generations now, email is only used for work. They see it as very, very formal. So whereas for many millennials or elder millennials, like sending off an email to make plans for the weekend is not weird. For people who are younger, it's like texting only. Like that is, to send an email is like sending some weird vibes or weird signals, because they just had a different set of tools as they were growing up. So we all have these different perceptions. And another funny one is voicemail is like the least cool thing you could do, but voice notes are really fun and like okay to do, even though they're both asynchronous audio, right? They're both not real-time audio, but we have these different assumptions and feelings about them, which is part of why it's so valuable to have conversations as a group. Like, how do we want to approach things? What's best? Let's all get on the same page here, which is so rare. I meet almost no teams at all who've ever discussed communication norms. They just assume that we all get it, even though for good reason, people vary on these.
So I think the norms and establishing norms is really important. So how often do you need to do that? I mean, you know, teams do evolve and change, and there's new mm-hmm. people coming onto teams all the time. I mean, how often do you have to kind of norm set around communication like this?
Yeah, you know, it depends on the team. So if you notice things are starting to go awry, that's probably a good time. If you're having new people on the team, it's good. And one of these norm setting things that's best is to do it as a team as opposed to top down. When everyone feels like they have a voice in it, even if they don't get their way, they're much more likely to buy into the system. So as opposed to saying like, this is the best for us as a leader, we're doing it, actually having a conversation about what's best. So, you know, definitely when you have new people coming in, if you start to notice things going by the wayside, and there's always leakage because we start to get into habits that might not be best. And generally what I recommend in communication research, but also when I'm consulting about motivation, increasing retention, productivity, is continually experiment. Just because your team came up with the norms, maybe it's not the best approach. Being open and willing to have feedback about, well, maybe there's a way we could tweak this a little bit. As an extreme example, which I wouldn't necessarily recommend, Shopify basically canceled every single meeting off people's calendars, which is like an extreme example of we need to reset here. But doing this kind of more minor experimentation and saying, is there anything we could tweak here? How can we make things more productive? Is there a way we could bring a more work-life balance here without decreasing care to patients simultaneously? And often when you start to have these conversations, you start to question your assumptions and you're like, well, the thing we spent 2 hours meeting on, maybe we only need 30 minutes and the rest could be an email. And then we have all this extra time that we could do paperwork during the day that we don't have to bring home at night then. So we all can have some more balance. So questioning those assumptions is valuable.
Andrew, that's great. And this has been a really great dialogue. So fun. I can't believe our time is already up. Andrew, on behalf of Baptist, we want to say thank you. And again, for our listeners, I would tell you that not only is this great research, but your personal connection to your story really brings a lot of depth and perspective here. And so we want to thank you for that. So thank you for being a guest on Connecting the Dots podcast. And thank you for this important work. I would encourage all of our listeners to go out and get a copy of Ping, The Secrets of Successful Virtual Communication. Andrew, thank you.
Thanks. It's a great conversation.
Yeah, thanks, Andrew. This flew by.